I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're looking at the life and music of one of the most influential cultural figures of the past 50 years, David Bowie, and we'll be reassessing his remarkable legacy 10 years on from his death. You can send us your thoughts and views to talkinghistory@newstalk.com and we'd love to hear from you. Born in England in 1947, David Bowie was a singer, songwriter, actor and visual artist, widely regarded as one of the most influential figures in popular music. Achieving fame with the single Space Oddity in 1969, Bowie became known for constant reinvention, creating iconic personas such as Ziggy Stardust and the Thin White Duke. Across 5 decades, Bowie continually reinvented himself, reshaping popular music, performances, fashion and identity. He became a cultural force who blurred boundaries between art and life, masculinity and femininity, mainstream and the avant-garde. News of his death in January 2016 was met with a remarkable outpouring of grief. And so in tonight's show, we want to assess his life and his legacy. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Harriet Reid is project curator in the Theatre and Performance Department at the Victoria and Albert Museum and is part of the curatorial team behind the brilliant The David Bowie Centre at the V&A East Storehouse, the permanent home of Bowie's archive. Professor Owen Devereux is co-director of the Centre for the Study of Popular Music and Popular Culture at the University of Limerick, a cultural sociologist, creative writer and experimental musician. He's an expert on popular music, fandom, media and social meaning and has written on the work of David Bowie. Dr. Leah Cardos is Senior Lecturer in Music at Kingston University London, a musician and researcher. She's an expert on creative practice, popular music aesthetics and Bowie's late creative period, and is the author of Black Star Theory, The Last Works of David Bowie. Well, you're all very welcome. And Harriet, I might begin with you, and I might begin with a question of where David Bowie stands 10 years after his death. There was a remarkable outpouring of grief when he died 10 years ago. And I just wonder, in terms of his life, in terms of his legacy, in terms of how he is perceived as an artist, a performer, as I suppose a cultural phenomenon, where does Bowie stand today?
I mean, it's a fantastic question to start with, because I think he's entirely unique in that his legacy and cultural relevance have only sort of grown over the past 10 years. Obviously, at the V&A, we acquired David Bowie's archive, and we've just opened the David Bowie Centre, which contains 90,000 items which he collected over his lifetime. And since we sort of opened public access to that, we've been completely overwhelmed with requests to see material, to see objects and archival material. So we know firsthand that people are still incredibly connected to him. They feel emotional connection. But I think it's just sort of proven over time how forward thinking he was, how timeless his music was, and how much we've sort of lost, that we've lost that voice now in our cultural landscape.
And Harriet, it was an incredibly long career, but there were times when he was at the centre of popular culture and he was shaping it, and at times when his reputation wasn't as strong. I'm thinking, you know, we started Talking History 20 years ago. If we had done a show on David Bowie in 2006, there wouldn't have been anywhere near the same level of respect or attention or interest, because there were periods where he was kind of out of fashion, and then he found ways of reinventing himself and becoming at the centre of it again.
Yes, it's been a sort of interesting journey, and a really interesting way to look at sort of the 20th century as well through Bowie's career. Because he never stopped creating. And I think even in those periods, maybe when he wasn't a critical darling, or maybe wasn't at the total sort of forefront of a new musical frontier, he never stopped developing. He was always curious. He was always kind of culturally voracious, reading, going to theatre, going to gigs, listening to music. You know, he was still sort of determined to keep evolving as an artist. And I think that's what makes him different, that it didn't sort of prevent him from continuing to sort of push himself, and knew that, you know, eventually there would be a time when he would kind of be at the center of the cultural conversation again. That this was something that he'd encountered throughout his career. I mean, it took him several years from the very beginning to kind of have his first commercial breakthrough with Space Oddity, that he cycled through several bands, several lineups, before going solo. So failure and obscurity was not a new experience for him.
Leah, let's go back in time just 10 years to the release of his final album, Black Star, that you've written so powerfully about. It was released on the 8th of January, his 69th birthday. It had been recorded in secret. And then I think the fact that Bowie died 2 days later just added to the power and the poignancy of this final artwork.
Yeah, I mean, his death changed the artwork. It came out, and you know, in the 2 days where no one knew that he was ill, the critical reception were using words like opaque, and you know, it's inscrutable. And so, you know, when we found out that he wasn't well and that he had died, you know, it seemed like the album suddenly gained this translucence. It all sort of locked into place. It clicked in, and it felt like, it seemed like a plan, right? It seemed like, wow, what an amazingly stage-managed exit. And I think that kind of, you know, whether that's the truth or not of the matter, actually, we don't know. You know, the last song on the album is I Can't Give Everything Away. And, you know, through interviews with people behind the scenes, it seems to be the case that David was in a purple patch and was creating. And, you know, Black Star was recorded at the beginning of 2015, when he was actively in treatment and there was hope. It's not like it's actually a, oh, I'm dying, this is my final hurrah. But of course, and it ended up being that way. And when it's perceived that way, it just makes it more powerful and very resonant and haunting, you know. And I think on top of all of that, the fact that it's just a really good record, one of his best, arguably, I would say in my case, I think it is his best record, musically, compositionally, with his voice, everything, it just adds to it. You know, it was such a powerful gesture. And, of course, the two videos as well that came out, the Black Star video and the Lazarus video, again, some of his strongest work, you know, conceptually, cryptically, intellectually, artistically. So, you know, as a fan, it was enormously gratifying to see him at the top of his game at the end of his career, and also really shocking and sad and powerful. It's a lot of emotions to be hit with, you know, and it's something that I think also reflects the bravery of his career and the general boldness of his creative choices throughout his career.
And Leah, very struck by the word you use there, bravery, because that's the thing that really stands out for me, his extraordinary courage, not just the courage in those final months when he's dying of liver cancer, but throughout his career, the courage to try new things, to be laughed at, to experiment when it would have been a lot safer to just do the same thing over and over again, or even to go into a quiet retirement, but to be constantly striving to do new things and to keep performing and creating, that takes an incredible amount of courage.
Absolutely. And I think that that's one thing that has captured the public consciousness about David Bowie as an artistic figure since his death. I think people have sort of come around to realize just how bold, how interesting, and how challenging his work was consistently. And he wasn't afraid to be cringe, you know, to use that term that Gen Z love, because he was making big swings. He was trying stuff out. You know, at the time, people mocked Tin Machine, but looking back at it now, and I know that, you know, there's a lot of historical revisionism going on, but you can see an artist who is willing to set fire to his very, you know, well, his 80s persona that was, at the early 80s, very successful, and in the later 80s, at least financially successful. The Glass Spider Tour was a, you know, commercial success in terms of making money for him, but he absolutely burned it to the ground with Tin Machine. And then pivoting and following and being inspired by and being enlivened by new generation music styles in the 90s, you know, critics were mocking him and, you know, framing it as rather tragic, but when you look at interviews from that period and you look at the artist, you know, you can see someone who's very invigorated, very enlivened, and operating in a way that, you know, they themselves seem very excited. And it's just really lovely to see actual artistry in pop music. And I think Bowie was always a consummate artist. He wasn't just this commercial figure, you know, generating money for a record company. He was actually asking big questions, whether that's about alienation or depression or otherness, or in the later part of his career, you know, big questions about identity and existence. And I think that as well is something that, again, captured the public imagination since he died.
Owen, you've written powerfully about Bowie and his legacy and about the extraordinary range and versatility there, that this was an artist who painted, who produced, who acted, who recorded, who performed. There are so many different dimensions to his life and his career.
Sure. I mean, I would concur with the other contributors in terms of his significance and his reach. And I think a great deal of that comes from the reservoir of influences that Bowie drew upon, you know, Buddhism, German Expressionism, Surrealism, Dadaism, Kabuki philosophy, read really widely in terms of communications theory. You know, look at his predictions about the internet. Look at his predictions in 2002 about America First. So it's that kind of voraciousness in terms of his reading. I'm reliably informed that he read a book a day. And I often say to my students that, you know, when Bowie cleaned up his act and gave up alcohol and drugs, if you like, the new addiction became reading and books. And that shows in his work. I also think that a mark of a true artist is somebody who doesn't compromise, somebody who doesn't care, who is true to what he or she wants to actually engage in. And Bowie is certainly an example of that. I've written about his interest in Irish artists, Irish painters and Irish writers like Samuel Beckett, Jack B. Yeats, Colin Middleton, and so on. And I think he replicated this everywhere he went. So in an Irish context, you know, when he was here rehearsing, recording in Dublin, he would ask, you know, younger people about, you know, who the best DJs are, who the coolest bands are, where should he be going. He spent a great deal of time in the Hugh Lane Gallery in Dublin. It was a must go-to place for Bowie when he was working and living in Ireland. The extent of his knowledge about Samuel Beckett, about Jack B. Yeats, is really, really interesting to read. And just those little hints along the way. And I'm struck particularly by the Lazarus video, but also the video for Where Are We Now. I see a lot of Beckett in Bowie's thinking. And even though he kind of doesn't explicitly talk about Beckett in interviews, I mean, he does mention him, but it's not that explicit. And I suppose his greatest, I mean, you know, one of his great abilities was his capacity to synthesize, to bring together different ideas from occultism, from philosophy, different musical styles. And that's really where it becomes fascinating, because the canvas is so wide. You know, his long life interest in Pierrot the Clown, in the Commedia dell'arte, you know, so he's simply drawing on so many influences. And I suppose semiotically, then, there are so many hooks and images and references. I was really delighted to visit the Bowie exhibition in the V&A in late October. And what really struck me weren't his guitars or his xylophone or his synthesizer or his clothes, But what I was really taken with were photocopies, photostats of Bowie's notes from the studio for Black Star, for example. And you're seeing these annotations, you know, the direction he's giving the other musicians and Tony Visconti. And again, the reference points to other bands, to other musicians. It's really, really, really fascinating.
And Owen, do you think that even one of his iconic hairstyles was actually influenced and modelled on Samuel Beckett?
Well, he's made a joke about that himself. Yeah, he appeared on the BBC, on BBC Radio, and he did make the joke about Bono sending him, I'm nearly sure it was Anthony Cronin's Beckett, The Last Modernist, that book. And he did make that joke about having a haircut like Samuel Beckett. So I think, yeah, I mean, I know from my own research and studies that, you know, he would have been a reader of Beckett, a watcher of, you know, Beckett's other mediums like film with Buster Keaton and so on, you know. And, you know, so he talks about this. He talks about Bono sending him two wonderful bios on Samuel Beckett. And he says, you know, Beckett is a hairstyle not dissimilar to the one I'm sporting, you know. And, you know, and again, you know, even in songs, there is a reference to on the album Earthling. Samuel Beckett's father is reputed to have said, "Oh, what a morning," as his parting words to the world. And Bowie paraphrases this as, "Oh, what a morning," you know. So he's very clued in. And, you know, I'm not saying he's a plagiarist, but, you know, he's kind of a cultural magpie, and his ability to pull in different references are just really endlessly fascinating. So from a fan point of view, you know, there's so much in the content that Bowie knowingly created. Many years ago, I interviewed David Mallet, the man who directed the video for Ashes to Ashes. And that was very instructive because Mallet talks about how Bowie and himself, how they collaborated in terms, like Bowie literally imagined the video frame by frame, you know, sketched it out on postcards in terms of what the Ashes to Ashes video might look like, you know. So he's always conscious in terms of what he's projecting. So it's fascinating, endlessly fascinating.
Harriet, let's go back in time then to the start of his career, maybe that pivotal period, creative period from maybe 1967 to Scary Monsters and Super Creeps being released in 1980. An incredibly creative period where you have albums like The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust, you have Aladdin Sane, you have Low, which many critics always say is his greatest album. But it's also an incredible period in terms of his invention and reinvention with these different personas like Ziggy Stardust, that in terms of his what he was wearing, how he was presenting himself, that he was stretching boundaries musically and artistically.
Yes, I mean, only within that sort of short span of a few years, it's incredible to think about how many personas, how many sort of era-defining albums he produced, and it's really evident. It's great to hear, Owen, about your experiences in the center and looking at that material, because you're absolutely right. Bowie was behind every single vision for each album and each sort of character he portrayed. He was restless. He was, you know, looking for reinvention, looking for the next sound, the next, you know, the new types of instrument, new types of experimentation, new collaborators. So there's an incredible sort of cycle of new sounds, new albums, new identities, I guess, that Bowie wanted to kind of explore. And a lot of it is sort of pivoting away from the previous. Obviously, there's the famous killing off of Ziggy Stardust at the Hammersmith Odeon, where he disbands the Spiders from Mars and pivots to Diamond Dogs and Young Americans and his soul sound. He was at the peak of his powers, the peak of his success. They could have kept touring for another 5 years and kept along on that journey. But Bowie anticipated the end of glam, that he took it as far as he wanted to take it. And he was completely immersed in American culture, in soul music, and kind of created this plastic soul character with the Young Americans album. So I think it really just comes from a relentless creativity, a desire to learn and try and be curious. In the archive, we have incredible sort of progress charts from the 60s, where he's outlined year by year, month by month, what projects he's working on, when he wants to finish them, from musicals to soundtracks to photo shoots to albums to collaborations. So we know that he was incredibly determined, almost kind of ruthlessly creative. So there was almost a kind of sense of time was always against him, that there wasn't enough time for him to create what he wanted to create and establish that legacy. And that's also really interesting to think about in terms of Black Star as well, that, you know, he knew that time was running out still. So that is a kind of thread, I think, that we see throughout that period. Yeah, from the characters of Ziggy Stardust, the Halloween Jack, obviously the Pierrot clown in Ashes to Ashes, they're complete sort of deviations from one another. And I think they're really interesting testaments to the creativity of the people he worked with. So costume designers like Freddie Beretti and Natasha Korneloff. Bowie obviously is behind every concept. He is the leader of these projects and he knows exactly what he wants to achieve. But we shouldn't sort of dismiss the ingenuity of a lot of his collaborators and the people who kind of create those images with him.
Oh, and how successful was he in the 1970s? Was he commercially very successful? Was he more of a niche artist? It seems, in looking at the chart placings for the singles, it seems like there was sometimes critical acclaim, but not always popular acclaim.
I think there was a mixture of things going on. Certainly, I've often thought about Bowie, how Bowie is one of the few artists who survived punk. If you think about punk in 1976, 77, which kind of swept away all the dinosaurs, Bowie is really one of the few people who remains cool, who remains, you know, a figure of significance. And, you know, and Bowie had his trials and tribulations around money and about, you know, about lost royalties and so on. So it was a mixed experience for him. Something I did want to stress is a lot of the time when there are narratives about Bowie in the early part of the century, when they talk about him becoming ill and his heart attack, and, you know, many commentators talk about him disappearing. But in reality, I don't agree with that narrative at all, because even when he was very quiet and invisible after being ill, he continued to do things that stimulated himself intellectually. He curated the Highline Festival in New York. He collaborated with Arcade Fire. He went to really cool DJ clubs in New York. So even when he was, you know, reclusive, apparently, and not doing things publicly, he was still doing that. And again, I mentioned Jack B. Yeats earlier, and the parallels with Jack B. Yeats are interesting in that Jack B. Yeats adopted a number of personae as an artist. And what is interesting about Bowie, I often say to my students that in one sense that David Bowie didn't exist, that David Jones existed, and then he played all of these different characters throughout his career very, very usefully. And again, it's something he's very conscious of. If you think about a relatively recent video, Love is Lost, from his comeback album in 2013, even in that video, he is drawing upon older personae and effectively killing them off. You know, so it's very, very, a very interesting figure.
And why does he change his name from David Jones? Is it because of, I think there's already a singer there from the Monkees, and why is it the name Bowie that he chooses?
Well, give a man a mask and he will tell you who he is. You know, I think there was a comfort in playing different characters and yet protecting his own life, you know. And of course, the real danger in the 1970s, when cocaine is a factor and drugs are a factor, one of the issues for Bowie in the early 70s is that David Jones and David Bowie, or the characters that David Bowie is playing, become a bit muddled and become a bit mixed up. But then when he cleans up his act, he's David Bowie, and he's not necessarily resorting to being Halloween Jack or the Thin White Duke or whatever. So it's a protective mechanism in one sense, and allows him great freedom then to play roles. And of course, Bowie then, you know, I remember reading an interview with him once where he said, you know, he's talking about doing X or Y, but then he admits that, well, I could be just, you know, having a joke on you all, you know, and you know, pulling the wool over your eyes. Who knows, you know? So he's always very conscious of his relationship with his audience.
Leah, he also had a very distinctive look, and partly it was because of an accident when he was 15. There was a childhood fight, and his eye was damaged, and it meant that one eye looked different, so that gave him a unique look, and then he kind of followed that up in terms of the fashions, the styles, these identities and personas that he created.
Yeah, I mean, I love this idea that with his one permanently dilated pupil, he saw the world a little bit differently, and I like that. And you know, I think there's sort of difference. You know, when you look at Bowie in his 20s, I mean, he was a beautiful man. And I think the beauty is also strange and queer. And I think he represented something androgynous, something other, in a very kind of seductive and appealing way, but also in a validating way. I think people could recognize his otherworldly beauty, but also recognize that it was okay to be different. And it was actually great to be different. And so I think, you know, his look was really meaningful. And I think it also filtered down into, you know, what people got from his music and how he kind of articulated people's isolation or perhaps their difference. And I think that's really important.
And it's interesting what you say, because there was always a huge interest in his sexuality, especially in that period in the 70s and early 80s, and whether he was gay or bisexual. And there was always a fascination because of his androgynous persona, or sometimes some of these images that he presented, and very much blurring boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember his sexuality being a big conversation. But if you go back and look at his addressing of it, aside from, you know, in the 80s, I think he denied being gay. But, you know, people sort of use these points as like, you know, to try and claim him for one side or the other. But he did definitively set the record straight in the late 80s and early 90s by saying multiple times to the press that he was a bisexual person. And I like that. I think, you know, he does quite a lot for bisexual visibility in the public consciousness. And I think, you know, he's a queer icon, and for very good reason. And actually, not just his sexuality, but his gender presentation, I think, was also very meaningful, from, you know, using drag in his videos, pulling in subversive semiotics from those underground scenes. I think he did great work for diversity in pop and also for acceptance, definitely.
Owen, we haven't mentioned many of the actual songs. So in terms of that period in the 70s, when you listen back now, songs so iconic like Heroes or Life on Mars or Ashes to Ashes in 1980, they are timeless because they don't sound like songs of the 70s. They sound like songs that could be created in the 21st century because they're otherworldly, and they're, well, perhaps not Heroes, maybe the other ones, but that there is something that is timeless about them that they don't date.
Yes, because they deal with universal themes like alienation and anomie. You know, there is that sense that they are, I mean, I think the mark of a true artist, and Bowie is a true artist, the mark of a true artist is the timelessness of the art that's created. And I'm pretty confident that Bowie's music will be listened to in 100 years' time or 1,000 years' time, you know, and will stand the test of time. So there is a timelessness about what he was creating. I think it's something else that I'd like to maybe stress when we're talking about Bowie and diversity and so on. When he died 10 years ago, I went and I photographed many of the fan shrines. There was one in Brixton, there was one in New York and so on and elsewhere. And I was really interested in what fans said about David Bowie and what David Bowie meant to them. And those kinds of stories, you know, of making it being, you know, of David Bowie making it okay to be different. I mean, one of the fans wrote in a post-it note in Haddon Street in London, "Without you, I would be a different person. Thank you for the songs. They made me realize I wasn't alone in how I felt." And, you know, these kinds of things are replicated over and over and over again, because music like David Bowie's music is an example of how, you know, fans connect with music at an affective or an emotional level. And Nick Stevenson, a Bowie scholar, talks about Bowie being a beacon of hope, a reservoir of hope for fans, because what he's saying is that it is possible to change. It is possible to change who you are, your identity, how you look, how you behave, and so on. So it's always a great, it is a reservoir for fans. And again, it's just because of the themes of Bowie's music, dealing with issues around existence, most recently dealing with issues about our very mortality, about feeling dislocated, about feeling alienated. That is the kind of music, and those are the kind of words that resonate with people.
Well, we're going to take a quick break now and return by looking at his movie and acting career and his return and reinvention in the 1980s.
From Geico Subconscious News, I'm Tammy Racing Thoughts, broadcasting from your brain. You think you live in a pretty safe place, but you just heard about a break-in 4 miles away, which isn't close, but it isn't far either, you know? Art Palpitations is on the scene.
I sure am, Tammy, and I don't even know why I drove out here, because as you know, you got customized renter's insurance through Geico, so your stuff is covered.
Oh, well, that's great. Any sign of crime there, Art?
Just some light littering, Tammy, but like they say, a little litter can lead to a lot.
Wise words. It feels good to worry less. It feels good to Geico.
Welcome back. We're Talking History, and tonight we are looking at the life, music, and legacy of David Bowie. I'm delighted to be rejoined by Harriet Reid, project curator in the Theatre and Performance Department at the Victoria and Albert Museum, and she's part of the curatorial team behind the brilliant David Bowie Centre at the V&A East Storehouse. Professor Owen Devereux, co-director of the Centre for the Study of Popular Music and Popular Culture at the University of Limerick, and Dr. Leah Cardos, senior lecturer in music at Kingston University, London, and the author of Black Star Theory, The Last Works of David Bowie. Harriet, could we talk about the acting career? Because it's still criticised by people, and I've never quite understood it, because in one of the movies that I certainly loved growing up, Labyrinth, I think he's phenomenal in that. Christopher Nolan had him playing Tesla in The Prestige. He was impressive in that. He made an appearance in David Lynch's Twin Peaks film. That I sometimes think he's mocked and criticised for his acting very unfairly.
Yes, I mean, I agree. I think many of his film performances are excellent. I think part of it is maybe down to the fact that people can't distinguish between the actor and the musician. It's very difficult for a very famous musician to kind of move into working in film and being an actor, that there is this sort of veil of fame and recognition, which is incredibly difficult to permeate. And I think Bowie delivers some really wonderful performances on a film. I think he was really interested in performing character, as we know, in his personas in music and through his albums and live tours. So that's obviously something that he was drawn to. And a lot of his choices really came from his own interest in working in particular directors, or was drawn to certain stories. And I think a lot of those films are sort of being reevaluated. Labyrinth obviously became a cult classic, but Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence as well, which he did in the 80s, about a prisoner of war in Japan, which is actually quite a radical sort of queer love story, I think has been reappraised, and he delivers a really sensitive performance in that. And of course, The Man Who Fell to Earth, directed by Nick Rogue, from 1976, which he was sort of cast based upon his performances and persona at that time. This sort of ethereal, alien-like figure was exactly what they were looking for that film. And then, of course, one of the film stills was then used on the cover of Low. So I think there's also this sort of exchange as well from film to music, and both sort of experiences influencing the other side of his career, which is really interesting.
Owen, he seems to have gone into a decline in the early 1980s and then had that remarkable revival and comeback with the release of Let's Dance, and followed by China Girl. And suddenly he was back at the height of his fame. And I think he had one of his biggest ever successes with Let's Dance.
He did, really. And, you know, he had signed a new record deal, was clearly hungry to get out and tour the world and tour and play in much larger venues. You know, so he went from, 3,000-5,000 capacity venues to playing stadiums, and it was simply ginormous. The iconography, the representations were very different, again, sharp suits and so on. And many people write off that time in terms of its commercial success and the quality of the songs. But again, from my money, it's here's David Bowie doing stuff that he wants to actually do. And certainly thinking back on it now, looking like he was enjoying what he was doing at the time. You should mention as well, though, when you talk about Bowie in movies, you don't forget his stage performance in Elephant Man. I mean, that's hugely significant. He acted on Broadway in 1980 and played the role of John Merrick 157 times. And I think that was an absolutely incredible piece of acting work. And, of course, where he lampoons and parodies himself in Ricky Gervais' Extras, where he sings this funny song, you know, "Hey, little fat man," you know, and it's very, very funny. So, again, a great sense of humor. But going back to the 80s, yeah, a very strong performance commercially and in terms of numbers. But Bowie, once he does that then and at the turn of the century, you know, again, he's already thinking ahead in terms of the next wave of albums and songs. So always working, always moving ahead.
I'll go back to Harriet, because one thing just struck me there. I'm wondering, what are visitors to the David Bowie Centre most interested in? Is it the Ziggy Stardust period of the 1970s? And I see from the website there's some wonderful items and artefacts from that. Are they interested in the music career just more broadly and generally? Is it Black Star? Is it the acting career? Or is it the whole range and versatility of the man and his legacy?
It's definitely a sort of mixture, I think. Obviously, Ziggy and his music career is the entry point for most people. We've seen a lot of fans book in to see some of the really iconic costumes, and those are very, very popular. But it's also what they're kind of discovering when they're within the reading room itself. So we've seen a few people book in to see certain material from the Diamond Dogs tour, for example, but when they're in the study room and then there's someone at another table looking at something completely different, they're then sort of discovering even more about Bowie from those conversations, and they're giving little talks and tours of what material they're looking at. So I think the wonderful thing is that there's a kind of an introductory point where people are booking to see the Bowie they know, but then they're discovering the Bowie they didn't know. And the centre, which has around 200 items on display from the whole archive, is also kind of introducing people to all these other aspects, which will hopefully inspire creatives, academics, fans, you know, casual visitors to look at Bowie, whether it's through the lens of, you know, the internet, his kind of pioneering use of it, his relationship to fans and fan culture, to, you know, his film career and stage career. So, yeah, it's been a really lovely journey to kind of see how people are starting to interact. But we've only been open a few months, so we're looking forward to seeing how people continue to use it.
Leah, when we look at that period in the 1980s and then going into the 1990s, how would you view David Bowie there? Is it a career in transition? Is it, again, the artist constantly reinventing himself?
Yes, it's a career in some kind of transition. I mean, a lot of people say that his 1987 album, Never Let Me Down, is a bit of a nadir, you know, a bit of a low point. But what's interesting to me is looking at some of the press he was doing in the lead up to the album dropping. He was talking quite animatedly about imagining a kind of heightened rock and roll theatre, a kind of way of amalgamating rock and roll and pop music with music theatre. And I think that he was really like trying to do something sort of in the vein and extending what he had done with the Diamond Dogs tour. And it critically, it kind of fell flat and the music didn't hit. But also there were pressures in the 80s for him to keep repeating the massive success of Let's Dance. And I agree with Owen that Let's Dance isn't, it's not bad. It's actually a good David Bowie album. It's just that it propelled him to a new status, a new part of the pop stratosphere where expectations were different and the audience was much more mainstream. And I think that having to cater to that audience or to even think about that audience or to, for the first time in Bowie's career, actually making money. I mean, through the 70s, he just wasn't making money for various reasons. And he had started, you know, strategically trying to figure out ways of becoming financially successful. And I think that, you know, in the 80s, perhaps he reached this point where he realized that artistically, he wasn't really hitting it and he needed to change. He needed to be reinvigorated. He seemed to be noticing underground and alternative rock coming through in America. He was a big fan of Pixies, their band and that style. And I think meeting Reeves Gabrels in the late 80s was a catalyst for him to try something new and try something fresh. And perhaps the instinct was there
to, as I said before, burn it all down to the ground and start again with something else. And I mean, this period, the late 80s and early 90s, I find absolutely fascinating, because what we're seeing is an artist really like sort of scrabbling around in the dirt and just trying to find his muse again, but also finding something quite exciting that I think sets up the way his music travels in the latter part of his career. It kind of, you know, some of the songwriting with Tin Machine, I think, is really strong, and it points towards the themes and the musical styles. And he sort of finds a new way of singing. He finds this sort of later style voice. I think this period of transition is a really great case study in, you know, the necessary, the necessity of failure. You know, sometimes failure is what you need in order to find yourself. And I think that that instinct that he had, again, points to what Owen was saying. This is a true artist. You know, he's sort of following the questions that he needs to answer in his work. And he has to make necessary changes to his aesthetic or to his approach or to his presentation as a performing artist in order to try and get at the answer to those questions.
Owen, it was my brother Tomás, who was 6 years older than me, who introduced me to David Bowie and that incredible period, late 70s, early 80s, and the music there. But I remember he wasn't, even amongst my friends, Bowie wasn't the loved, iconic figure that he is today. And that I sometimes think people reinvent their own musical tastes and musical history as well as time goes on. That there was still something edgy about him, wasn't there?
Well, absolutely. You know, I agree with you. And I'm thinking as well about then the kinds of people who might have been into Bowie. Certainly in Ireland, people like Gavin Friday and Bono, you know, early U2, Virgin Prince, they were hugely influenced by David Bowie. But no, he was to the edge. And as I say, he survived the kind of onslaught of punk. So, I agree. Yeah, he was slightly left of centre, you know, not ideologically, but, you know, slightly left of centre in terms of being a cool figure. And yeah, there is certainly a certain amount of reinvention. That's what happens sometimes when people become iconic figures. But my God, the music was just certainly Heroes, Low, Lodger, that work from the late 70s, just absolutely phenomenal. And then the influence that that had then on music in the 1980s and 90s, just really, really, really striking. One thing, Harry was talking about the archive, and I had my own eureka moment in the DNA when I'm really taken with Bowie's video for Black Star, and there's an image in that which comes from a particular book cover that he'd been reading a long time ago, where there were three people on crosses, crucifixes, and I found in the notes on one of the tables somebody else had been looking at a folder, and there was Bowie in the early 2000s designing a Christmas card to send out. And what's in the margins of the Christmas card? Three crucifixes with three people crucified on the crucifix. So it's that kind of, from a research point of view, from the historian's point of view, the stuff is just, there is just so much to go on. And I think I could spend the remainder of my life, whatever, however long that's going to be, just going through content of the Bowie archive, because it's going to be endlessly fascinating.
Endlessly fascinating. Well, we're going to take another quick break now. When we come back, we'll take that story up to his death in 2016. Welcome back. We're talking history, and we are talking about the life, music and legacy of David Bowie. Harriet Reid is the project curator at the Victoria and Albert Museum and is part of the team behind the brilliant David Bowie Centre at the V&A East Storehouse, which is the permanent home of the David Bowie Archive. Professor Owen Devereux, co-director of the Centre for the Study of Popular Music and Popular Culture at the University of Limerick, and someone who's written extensively on the work of David Bowie, and Dr. Leah Cardos of Kingston University London, who's the author of that wonderful book, Black Star Theory, The Last Works of David Bowie. So Leah, maybe take us then up into that final period then of Bowie's life, because we've mentioned Tin Machine and re-examining or re-evaluating that period, which was certainly hugely criticised at the time. And then it goes into that more difficult later period where there's occasional releases. He does that beautiful haunting song, Where Are We Now, in 2013. There's the Black Star album in 2016. There's occasional singles that break through. How would you describe and define that period?
Well, I think that it's important to note that he kind of reaches this stable equilibrium sort of in the late 90s, settling in Manhattan, reconnecting with Tony Visconti, the music producer who incidentally produced, you know, his first album, self-titled album, knew him from the very start and connecting with him at the end of his life. And, you know, Tony Visconti produced all of the records from Heathen all the way to Black Star from this period. And I think that this period feels like a late style. It's stable. He's in one place. He's examining these themes of sort of existence and morality and identity and spirituality. He's looking at the shadow a lot, you know, and his voice is also settled into a kind of late voice. And I think it's important to note this because, you know, had his heart attack not happened in 2004, I think he would have been working consistently through this period. But, you know, so he has Heathen coming out in the early millennium and then Reality quickly after and then the world tour. And then, of course, he has periods of illness. But in the background, leading up to, you know, his reemergence with Where Are We Now in 2013, in that background where he seemed to have been retired from public life, he was still working behind the scenes. You know, in 2005, he purchased the rights to the book The Man Who Fell to Earth by Walter Tevis with the intention of developing it into a musical or a play with music. And he was actively working with Robert Fox to find a playwright. And, you know, if you sort of dig around some interviews and little bits and pieces where he was mentioned, there is a mention of around 2006 that he was working with John Guare and then with Michael Cunningham. And, you know, he was sort of sniffing around even Connor McPherson looking for somebody and then ended up with Ender Walt. And this was like, I think, a background activity that was happening all the way from 2006, developing it actively to 2015 when the play premiered off-Broadway.
So, Leah, yes, let's talk about that. Let's talk about that play and its impact and significance.
Yeah, well, I mean, Lazarus, it doesn't get talked about very much, and I think that makes sense because it's just not as accessible as the albums are and the music videos, you know, and only a certain handful of people have been to see it, particularly that first iteration that was directed by Eva Van Hove. And we have, it's also very haunting, right, because it's you know, notionally fictional about Thomas Jerome Newton, but it's also about somebody who is dying, who's dealing with death, who is trying to let go, who's going through some kind of death dream, some kind of bardo state, you know, towards rebirth and dealing with their attachments. And there's a lot of, you know, Owen was talking about this sort of cryptic knowledge, this sort of cryptic aspect to Bowie's work, you know, how he's referencing quite obscure things, and that opens up this wonderfully enjoyable depth to Bowie's work. You can really go in and find things, and there's a lot of sort of breadcrumb trail following. But yeah, I mean, Lazarus is such a dense presentation, and it is really about end of life. And I think, you know, when we talk about somebody using their art to try and reckon with and process their mortality and their fears around it and their concerns, I think Lazarus is probably the more serious work compared to Black Star. But, you know, his lifelong dream of creating musical theater, I mean, there is this sort of timeline that goes right back to his earliest forays into performing arts, you know, as a mime supporting supporting Mark Bolan and Tyrannosaurus Rex on tour as a mime, you know, doing some weird sort of enaction of the invasion of Tibet by China. And then, you know, all the way through wanting to do a Ziggy Stardust musical involving roller skates and some kind of weird black hole situation. And then going through to even wanting to stage an opera of One Outside, you know, put on this crazy show about Leon in India. Or as we know from the V&A archive now, he was also developing this project called The Spectator, and he had all sorts of ideas. And so I think, you know, the idea of blending pop music and rock music with theatre was like a lifelong aspiration for David Bowie. And so the fact that Lazarus got staged at the 11th hour is, I think, incredibly meaningful, and it would have meant a lot to him.
And Owen, of course, another wonderful Irish connection there with that creative link with Enda Walsh.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, if you look at Bowie's top 100 books, we see Spike Milligan there. You know, we see, as I've mentioned previously, you know, an interest in Irish painters, but always asking questions about about writing and about who is publishing what and so on. So there is that voraciousness there, which is a constant for Bowie, and really, 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 really interesting. And don't forget, of course, we were talking about movies and theatre, you know, appeared in the late 60s in Pierrot in Turquoise on Scottish television, you know, so the acting career goes right back. And there is that just restlessness, and I mean restlessness in a positive way, there's a kind of a creative restlessness with Bowie over his entire career. And, you know, it's just endlessly fascinating, the strange fascination that he created in his art.
And Harriet, it is interesting walking around Dublin, going into places over the last few days. David Bowie is playing in the background. David Bowie is being remembered. David Bowie is being celebrated on the 10th anniversary of his death. What do you think his legacy will be? Do you think it will change or evolve? Or has he been, I suppose, anointed now as one of these great cultural iconic figures who played such a transformational role in terms of music and art and culture over this extended period?
And I think that's already sort of happened. I think he's already been anointed as a major cultural figure, you know, one of the most important cultural figures of the 20th century, of no doubt on the 21st. And I mean, our hope in sort of making his archive publicly available is that he continues to be considered that, but also continues to be studied, researched, critiqued, reevaluated, brought into new historical contexts, perspectives. You know, we want researchers across disciplines, not just sort of musicologists, to look at his career and look at it from different viewpoints. So I think it always will be. I think he's safely in the canon of you know, the greatest artists of our time. That hand reaching out to the listener, I think, is so unique with him, and that's why his music will stand the test of time.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, Harriet Reid, Project Curator in the Theatre and Performance Department at the Victoria and Albert Museum, the permanent home of the Bowie Archive, Professor Owen Devereux, Co-Director of the Centre for the Study of Popular Music and Popular Culture at the University of Limerick, and Dr. Leah Cardos, Senior Lecturer in Music at Kingston University, London. We have more debate and discussion next week, so I hope you can join us then. We've been talking history. Good night.
Saying no, but meaning yes. This is all.